Hey, everybody. Welcome to Hobbs and Friends with the OSR. I'm Jason Hobbs, your host. And today I've got my guest, the premier guest of Hobbs and the OSR, Eric Hoffman. How's it going, Eric?
I like that. Premier. Tell Carlos he's second fiddle.
He already knows.
Glad to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you on this very, very special Hobbs and Friends of the OSR episode. It's specifically about Swords and Wizardry Appreciation Day, and hopefully it drops on Saturday, April 22nd, which is Swords and Appreciation Day. So what's been going on, Eric? I mean, I've already introduced you once before. I guess we were at GaryCon together. That we can talk about that briefly. The last couple episodes, I've had people that were all at GaryCon with me. I don't know if I was just making a list while I was there and kind of check it off or what. But you got any initial comments about post GaryCon?
Yeah, sure. It was a great con. I really enjoyed it. Always do, especially at the new venue. A lot of good games and a lot of great gamers, even though I look back and I'm like, wow, what gaming did I do? And I think we did a couple of pickup games that were a lot of fun, but I did a lot of miniatures gaming, which is one of the big draws of GaryCon for me. Paul Stormberg hosts the Legends of Wargaming, and it's all war games like from the founding of the hobby. So games that were either important to the designers or important that the designers played that gave them the direction to Dungeons and Dragons. So there's a lot of history involved, and a lot of the old time guys are there. So for instance, this year I got to play Tractics, which is a World War II. Actually, it's all like all kinds of different modern combat, but it was like written mostly for World War II tanks and some infantry. And I got to play with Mike Reese, who wrote it originally, and Gary Gygax assisted. So it was one of the war games that Gary Gygax wrote that he was involved in other stuff. So that was really cool. We got to play in also a classic warfare game, which Gary Gygax wrote as well. And that's really interesting. And there's like no dice. It's all just math of like what troops are fighting which troops. And so that was interesting and different.
That sounds crazy.
Yeah, it was pretty neat. And then, of course, we played the game that we kind of co-ran. Black Powder, Black Magic, and Treasure Vaults of Zadabad mashup. That was a lot of fun, off-book, and a big surprise for some of the guys who were there. We actually ended up having a kind of a MacGuffin in the game that when this thing happened, every once in a while, you could switch characters, but also the judge, the referee, the DM could switch. And people were surprised by that, but then really got into it and had a blast.
Yeah, that's the one that everyone that Forrest was talking about and Paul, the last two episodes of Hobbs and Friends, both of those guys were involved with that game and they mentioned it as pretty interesting. About those old miniature war games, you kind of got me into that a couple of years ago at GaryCon. I didn't do any this year because they were all full up and the way they did the featured events were all kind of messed up or something. So I don't know. I'm terrible at signing up for games anyway.
They've almost got it right. You know, GaryCon's like always had a problem with registration. And actually this year, I don't think it was their fault. I think it was kind of the way that some people submitted games caused some confusion. And it's almost there, though. It's almost workable.
All right. The only game you left out is Paul Wolf's Frontier Space. Did you have anything you wanted to say about that, Air Stevedore?
Yeah, the Stevedore. I got elected to be captain of the ship, but I demanded that everyone call me Commodore, and so of course the entire table immediately just started calling me the Stevedore to put me in my place. So that was a lot of fun, and we played like a Firefly type of game that Paul ran. It's interesting. The rule system was, I don't know, it was nothing too, it didn't jump out at me too much, right? I mean, it just seemed like a pretty simple, workable sci-fi game. I would say it's a little bit more complex than White Star, but not nearly as complex as like Traveler. So it's kind of like in that middle ground. I think it's supposed to try and be a retro clone of Star Frontiers, right?
Yeah, precisely. And we talked about it at length, or when I say we, I mean me and the audience with Paul Wolf, but it's always good to hear someone else's concept about it. So that was fun. I had a great GaryCon, and it was, as usual, it was awesome hanging out with you and going out to Simple for breakfast almost every day.
Yeah, that was good. Oh, yeah, and we got to meet Harley Stroh for the first time, because he usually doesn't come to those games, so that was awesome.
That's true. He was the first person I ever met that was adamant that we'd met before.
Well, you're just ubiquitous, Scott Hubbs.
I guess. No, he said the same thing about you, so don't even try it. I want to get this introduction wrapped up so we can get into Swords and Wizardry, since this is the special episode for about that. So the Everything About You segment, you didn't get to do it in the first episode because it didn't start until the second one with Jose, but it's a segment of the show where I try and say something about myself that the audience might not know, and hopefully the guests can do the same. For me, I would like to say that right now is a pretty exciting time in sports ball, and I know all my audience is very interested in professional sports, but I live near Chicago, and both the Chicago Bulls and the Chicago Blackhawks are in the playoffs. The Bulls are doing way better than anyone expected, and the Blackhawks are doing way worse, so it's a pretty interesting time at my house. What about you, Eric?
Very cool. So a thing about me is actually happened at GaryCon just a couple of weeks ago. I was fortunate enough to be able to play in a charity game at the house that Gary Gygax lived in when he wrote Dungeons & Dragons with about 12 other guys. I got a tour of the house and met the current owners and got some history, and it was very, very cool.
There's kind of a cool background to that story as well. Before you even got to go to it, you're like, hey, I can't remember how the conversation started, but I totally mistook it as a poker game at Gary Gygax's old house. And I tried to get into it. And the guy goes, no, it's not a poker game. It's a charity event. Oh, okay. My bad.
Yeah, that was funny. That's it. There you go. That's a quick IMing while we're at work. There's always something lost in translation.
No kidding. All right. So obviously I want to talk about Swords and Wizardry today. You and I played a game together. I really wanted Todd Sprang to be involved in this because he was probably one of the longest running games that was Swords and Wizardry that I've ever played in. Todd's an awesome guy. He's a friend of the OSR for sure. I think he's still playing like in Hackmaster with Billy Compton. I don't know if you knew that, but whatever, I guess. You got any initial thoughts about Swords and Wizardry, Eric?
Yeah, you know, I got a lot of thoughts. I really like it. The lineage of Swords and Wizardry really goes back to, at least, you know, somebody probably tell me I'm wrong, but the origins of the OSR, since, you know, Matt Finch wrote the original Swords and Wizardry, and then also Osric, which was kind of the product that tested the OGL, right, to see if Wizards would actually come and sue people who just copied pretty much verbatim old rule sets. To me, that is really how the OSR exists, right? At least the retro clone part of it, and the new products that are coming out is because of kind of that, those things happening in that order. And Swords and Wizardry is really cool. I think it's got some pretty cool simplifications to the rules. One thing a lot of people like about it is probably the most glaring thing is it's a single save system. So you just have one saving throw, which at first when I read it, I was like, oh, well, that's not fun, you know. But then I went back and looked at the saving throw charts. They just don't make any sense, you know. There's no real rhyme or reason to them, pretty much. And so it's just a one save mechanic, and then different classes or races get bonuses, pretty hefty bonuses. Like, I think dwarves get a bonus to poisons or something, right? And so it makes up for that, and it mimics it, and halflings get a bonus to everything because they're lucky. But anyway, a single save mechanic is very cool. And then also, there's a couple different versions of Swords and Wizardry. There's the original, then there's complete, and then there's White Box, which is another rule set that kind of more mimics the original Dungeons & Dragons rules, where hit die is D6 and all weapons do basically D6. And it's kind of a stripped down, real simple game, which really then spawned a ton of what people call hacks. So White Star, I mentioned earlier, is a sci-fi hack of that. And there's White Lies, and which is like a James Bond hack, and Operation White Box, which Pete Spahn did, which is a World War II game. So it really became like this core rule set that launched, you know, 1,000 OSR hacks, if you will.
Yeah, it was the original hack that people used. Because, I mean, it's kind of what the White Hat came out of, maybe, what the Black Hack then later came out of. But, I mean, like you say, there's tons and tons of direct use exactly the Swords and Wizardry White Box as their chassis, for sure. There's no doubt about that. So that is a powerful thing concerning Swords and Wizardry. That single save, when you first look at it, it is kind of a jarring concept. Why would that be okay? But I did the same thing as you did. Then you kind of go back and you look over 1E or Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, and you're like, well, why are these strange esoteric things and how, what do they even make sense in reality? And how would you even know which one to use if you're making up your own stuff, right? It's just kind of like, there's no basis for it. It's just kind of one of those subsystems in the game that is just kind of esoteric or weird. I would agree with that. So I'm not saying that I use single save normally, because as what we've said before, both of us usually run BX, right? So it uses the five save system, but that would be one add-on that I could probably easily do, and it wouldn't bother my game. In fact, it would probably make it more simple. You agree?
I do. Yeah, and I really like that. And also the other mechanic that I like is there's ascending and descending armor class, and so all of the armor classes are given in both. So, you know, one of the things that, I mean, we still play descending armor class in a lot of my games because for nostalgia reasons, but really there's no good reason to do it. You know, it's right. So much simpler to use ascending armor class. The odds are the same. You still roll a d20. It's just, you're only adding instead of adding and subtracting, which was really just, you know, more math than you need to do.
Yeah. It reminds me of an old, argument that I used to have with Adam Miskevich all the time about me saying ascending AC was easier than descending. And he's like, no, adding is not easier than subtracting. Okay. Yeah, Adam, that's another thing you said that makes no sense, but
well, I love Adam. I'll just say that.
Well, you know, I do too. I think that's probably Julian Burnick would agree with that. Cause that guy's, you know, he's like antithesis to Hobbs and Friends or something. All right. So, I think, like, how many have you played tons of different games of Swords and Wizardry? And when you did, which rules did you use? Core or Complete or White Box or what?
I've played a fair bit. A lot of, there was a bunch of Flail Snails games that have run Swords and Wizardry at times. So I played in those. Played briefly in Todd's Rappanathic game for, it wasn't briefly, it was a month or 2 months or so. I don't know if I've ever run Swords and Wizardry. Oh, I played in Jeffrey Tadlock ran Swords and Wizardry pickup games here and there. I played in a couple of Barrow Maze games. I think we used that rule set. Played in some Swords and Wizardry with Wayne Rossi online, and I think that was White Star with James Spahn, which is, you know, kind of a derivative of White Box Swords and Wizardry. So yeah, I played a fair bit. I've got most. I think I have all the rule sets, and I also converted one of our works at Stormlord Publishing to Swords and Wizardry. So had to get pretty familiar with it through that.
Yeah, you probably shouldn't name that work because it's already been named in every other episode. So let's just skip that and it'll just be like a mystery to everyone.
Well, did anyone mention that it's up for a Three Castles Award?
I did a few episodes ago.
I should listen to more Hobbs and Friends of the OSR.
No kidding. It's like all my friends actually don't listen to the show. They're a bunch of a-holes. They hear enough of me babbling all the time, so they don't worry about listening to me on a podcast.
I usually catch up on plane rides, and I haven't had to travel the last couple of weeks. So.
Oh, all right. Well, that makes sense. You're feeling lucky then, right?
Exactly.
I ran Swords and Wizardry, my own Rappin' a Thuck one-shot at a very small personal convention that we call NeilCon that happens in DeKalb over by Sycamore. But I mean, that was only like a one shot, but I mean, the rule system is simple enough that it's very similar to a lot of the other things that we use. So, you know, it isn't a problem. That's a nice thing about it. I would say that it's probably one of the top retro clones, or like you say, maybe close to one of the oldest, right? I don't know, Labyrinth Lord, Castles and Crusades, I guess, and Swords and Wizardry, you'd probably say those are maybe the top three most known, maybe, right?
Yeah, probably. I would definitely say, for me, the retro clones of like the basic game, it would be Swords and Wizardry and Labyrinth Lord would be top. Castles and Crusades is like really a first edition, kinda.
Okay, yeah.
It's not really a retro clone. It's really a whole new system because it uses bits and pieces from lots of different editions. I would say, you know, Labyrinth Lord hews pretty closely to BX, and Swords and Wizardry pretty close too, but they make some significant changes. As far like the two that jump out at me are the two we mentioned already.
And like you say, just to reiterate, the total number of things that Swords and Wizardry has spawned is an impressive lineage. Just to talk about, you know, its Hall of Fame status as a game system, I guess. And they just did another printing that was all done by women. So, I mean, that's pretty awesome art and writing, right? So that's some forward thinking by the Mythmere Games and the Swords and Wizardry people. So I applaud that for sure. Let's talk about Todd's specific game a little bit. We both got to play in it, and like you said, it went for, I mean, I don't even know how many sessions we did, 15 to 20 sessions maybe?
Maybe a little less than that, but ballpark, say 15.
It was mostly set up as a hex crawl, which is what Wrapping a Thuck is mostly. If he added a bunch of different things to it, and one aspect that I wanted to talk about is that we attempted to use some of the optional rules in initiative. Do you remember that?
I do, and I did not care for them. In fact, I never understood them. Like, I tried to understand them, and I couldn't. And I mean, I'm sure I could if I would have spent the time, but it was just easier for me to say, Todd, tell me when it's my turn.
I kind of worked with him. It is a basic rule set, and it definitely follows the rulings, not rules mantra of the OSR. And so it was kind of this idea that was concerning speed factor, but not only of weapons, but also like what armor you were wearing affected when you happened to go in the initiative. So when you rolled your initiative die, it was modified by what armor you were wearing and what type of weapon you were wearing. So your initiative modifier would change each round depending on what you were doing. And you only got a single... The weird thing was movement. The way movement worked in with it is basically everybody moved every time anyone took an action, but you could only take, you know, say a 5-foot square or whatever, because he was using grids on roll 20. So it was kind of confusing, and I don't think we ever perfected it. And in some ways, I wonder if it wasn't part of the demise of the campaign. Just because it made combat even longer. It was still a cool experiment as far as I was concerned, because initiative is something that I think that you can play with. I'm not sure it's perfect. I know that you believe in the one team rolls a D6 and the other team does, and we go from there. But I use my own spin on that when I run Adventure Conqueror King, which I had to get that in there since you didn't mention it as a retro clone of BX, which is a D6. And then I want to allow people to have that have character classes that have skills that increase their initiative to still help them, because otherwise I think you're limiting that class some without that. So, and then it also, it's easier for individual monsters if you have a group of monsters that have a bonus of initiative, even though rolling an initiative die for each individual monster would be a super pain in the ass, and I pretty much never do it. It's very easy to do it for characters to do it, because each player can roll their own D6, and then you just, you know, use that initiative modifier and go from there. What do you think of that?
Well, we could do a whole episode on my thoughts about initiative, but that's really one of the main reasons that I like to play a basic game, is that, you know, I've thought like long and hard on initiative, and I've never had more fun in a game because it had a complex initiative system, and I've never had less fun because we just did roll a D6 and your side goes. So it's just easier. Like, I don't mind all the extra. So you brought up axe, and I don't mind the layering of skills on top of things for the player's benefit. And even like in 3.5, it's easy as a DM to say, you know, there's only so many skills and you just have a DC, right? 5, 10, 15, 20. You know, it's easy to make that up on the fly. But where those mechanics to make players more unique or snowflakey, if you will, intersect with the speed of gameplay, there's none more glaring to me than initiative. And I just played a while last year in Andy Action's first edition game. He's still running it. I wish I could play with those guys on Thursday nights. But, you know, everyone used we played full-on first edition AD&D with the super ability score rolls and Unearthed Arcana. And people had, it was a D6 initiative, but people had like +4 to their initiative. So, you know, people had a 10 initiative regularly. Anyway, to me, it doesn't really add anything to the game. It just allows people to make these characters that are really, really fast. But at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter. And I particularly don't like later, like D20 systems where you roll once and then your initiative's set. If that's the case, then why even bother to, you know, it mucks things up, and it adds no fun to the game. I can see how players like it because they can make a character that has an advantage in that area, but it just never seems to translate to more fun, even when I was a player, and certainly not as a DM. I actually, Adam had a system, and I don't know if he invented it, Adam Muskevich, where I think he called it Vegas style, where It's just everybody who beat the monster goes, everybody who doesn't beat the monster goes. So it's a little bit of variable, but the DM doesn't have to think about individual initiatives or track it. It's up to the players. The only problem with that is you have to have players that are really engaged and paying attention. Otherwise, you know, you say, all right, is that everybody? And somebody's, you know, looking over in the other direction. And then you get, okay, the monsters go. And they're like, oh, wait a minute, you forgot about me. My brother does that all the time. Drives me nuts. So so there you go. So I kept it to like 3 minutes of my rant on initiative.
You did cover a lot of it. Maybe we won't have to do another episode unless we want to hear you rant some more, which would be cool. That'd be fine.
Who doesn't want to hear that?
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean, we could do an episode about gnomes, and you could have me and Zach Glazar on, and it could be a debate.
I'll think about that. Not really. Okay, so let's talk about Todd's game again. Do you remember like anything about your character or anything specific about that game that you might want to talk about?
Yeah, well, I was playing a fighter, I'm pretty sure.
Like always.
I do, and I don't always intend that. It just works out that way. And yeah, I remember the dungeon. I remember getting into the dungeon. It was pretty deadly, as I recall.
Yes.
There was a slime room. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I remember the overland map, and there was some people hanging out in the forest, and we attacked some bandits. So yeah, I mean, it was just a kind of a standard, you know, old school hex crawl with a mega dungeon in it, right?
Precisely. You probably blocked this out, but we were trying to find bandits specifically, and we ended up having to go through all these copses of woods, hex by hex, trying to find them. And it was kind of tedious. The actual dungeon crawling was way funner for me because I map everything, and it was hard to do that because we're on roll 20 and he's just, you know, using fog of war and showing us what we see. So it's another thing about a hex crawl that I find can drag a game down. And if you have some ways of stopping that from happening or adding more aspects to the game to make it more fun within that sandbox, I think those would be great tools. So do you remember that or not?
Yeah, I do. I do. And I don't know what the answer is to stop that because in my game, I remember one session devolved into that. And in the Keep on the Borderlands game, I forget what everyone was looking for.
Bandits.
Like an old fort or something.
Lizard men, right? We were looking for... Oh, okay, that's true. We were looking for that old fort in the Tamaracks, too.
In the Tamarack stand, yeah. And literally, there were maybe, I don't know, 18 hexes that made up this little woodland group, maybe even less. And you guys searched every one and found the one last. I mean, you like went around it and then came... It was ridiculous. And all you can do there is the GM is like, all right, well... Roll for the wander, whatever your mechanics are set up for wandering monsters, right? Is about it. So sometimes it can be like that for sure.
Yeah, I haven't necessarily used when I GM'd. I kind of thinking about Swords and Wizardry in general again. When I GM'd it, I didn't necessarily use precisely their wilderness rules, but I own the Swords and Wizardry Complete with the Errol Otis cover, which is flipping awesome. I used to hate Errol Otis when I was a kid. But as when I've gotten older, he's definitely become a favorite of mine. And I really enjoy this book. I think it cost me $20 at a con, and it says $34.99 on the back. But the only better rule book I've ever gotten is that BX book that was combined that you gave me. So that's pretty cool. But we'll cover that hex crawl stuff another time with Jose, hopefully in the near future. But as far as Swords and Wizardry and Todd Sprang's Rappin' a Thug game specifically, I enjoyed it enough that I was writing journals, but I wasn't writing a journal from my character's point of view. I was writing it from my character's henchman's point of view, which I thought was pretty funny. I don't know if you ever read any of those or not, but...
Yeah, those were funny.
It was pretty funny because they hated each other, and it was just basically the NPC talking bad about the... my player character the whole time. So, but when he finally died, then I got to play the NPC. And so, you know, it all worked out in the end, I guess. And it was fun. And I really appreciate Todd running that. And here's a vote for Todd coming out of hiatus with that game and bringing it back to life because I would enjoy playing Swords and Wizardry again. Do you have anything closing to say about that?
Yeah, no, I'd love to play it again. I think we were just kind of getting into the political stuff around. Somebody had gotten in trouble. Didn't someone get put in jail or something? Or one of the other guys we were playing with, That's why we were hunting those bandits, is because one of the player characters got into trouble, and you know, as usual, that's that kind of like emergent, you know, give any players enough time and enough rope and they'll hang themselves and create an adventure for you, right? And that's kind of where we were. But on the other hand, you can also give them so much rope that they, you know, they bore themselves with their own mischief.
That's true. I feel like my players do that a lot. But anyhow, I appreciate the game Swords and Wizardry. And I should, even though this is Swords and Wizardry Appreciation Day, I should mention that Osric is having Appreciation Day as well. And it's in May, and I should know what the date is, but that's part of the bingo aspect of Hobbs and Friends, is I always don't have something that I should, and I mention it on the air. So there you go. But expect an episode about that coming up. So next, let's talk about a product spotlight. After Gary Con, or during Gary Con, I got to see one of my favorite artists, Jason Schultes, with Robert Parker. Jason Schultes signed my Dungeon Dozen for me. So I think it would be cool to talk about the book, The Dungeon Dozen, briefly as a product spotlight. And I asked you pre-show if you had it, and you said you did. I was surprised that it's 2014. I thought it was older than that for some reason.
So he had it on his blog for years, and he would like just drop one table every week or whenever he felt like it. And so the book was a compilation of that. So you've probably been reading it for a while.
Right, yeah, I think you're right. That's what it is looking at it. So how many there basically the whole concept of the book is it's I don't even know, over 100, it looks like D12 random tables, right? And it covers the gamut of anything you could almost possibly want a D12 random table for. And we talked briefly that it's not the easiest resource to use at the table in the middle of a game. I'm sure some people could if you were more familiar, if you got really familiar with it. But for me, there isn't a lot of time that the Enchanted Missile Weapons of Renown is going to come up in a game that I'm like, oh shit, I remember that's on page 54 of the Dungeon Dozen, and I'm going to use it. But during prep for one of the mini locations or point crawls or something that we might put in one of our hex crawl games, you could use this stuff very easily for inspiration. Right.
Yeah, for sure. Although I did just realize there is both a quick reference and an index in the back, as well as a table of contents in the front. So I probably just haven't put enough effort into using it at the table. But well, like just like you said, what I like to use it for is, so first of all, it's full of Jason's art, which is awesome. And he's
Yes.
working on Operation Unfathomable now, which is kickstarted, and it's his newest thing, which is going to be awesome. So his art is great next to all these tables, you know, kind of like maps to whatever it happens to be, like what's in the Ogre King's hoard, and there's a, you know, a great ogre, like, you know, tossing a boulder up and down like a baseball. And it's just these great tables that are everything from, you know, just kind of like a simple thing to like really weird, you know, old school sci-fi. Turn your campaign in a completely right turn. For that reason, I like to kind of use these things as inspiration and ideas for what I might want to put in the game. And then the other thing too is if you were doing like a weird dungeon or something, you could like reference one of these tables is another great way to use it, like dungeon weird floors or dungeon infestations, right?
If you were just running a one shot, you could use some of this stuff just as a quick idea. If you were totally improving it, you could easily improv a 4 hour or 2 hour or 3 hour session at a con with this book, and that's all you'd really need if you just made up the stats on the fly or whatever.
Yeah, that would be a crazy game.
It would be. So Jason Schultes also told me, and this is a bit of news just for you guys, my special listeners of Hobbs and Friends of the OSR, the Dungeon Dozen 2 is coming out as well.
Nice.
So that was pretty exciting. Schultes is awesome. I'm going to have him on the show eventually. So he already agreed to that. So that was nice. All right. So what do we have left? Looks like our next segment is the State of the OSR. All right. So sometimes on the show, I like to talk about important aspects of what's going on in the world of the OSR today. And this is something that's going around the blogs and the old forums, if people still use those, and the G pluses, is basically the fuck the OSR, I hate the OSR threads, blog posts, and comments going on around the internets. When I asked you about it earlier in the pre-show, you pretty much said that you'd only vaguely heard a little bit about it from, because you have so far paired out all the people who normally create the drama on G+, right?
Yeah. So first of all, almost all this drama always starts on forum message boards, which I just don't even do anymore. And on Google+, you can just not follow or unfollow the people who are involved in it. So I always hear about this stuff like when it bleeds over into G+, like 3 days later. So I did do some backtracking because one of the people who was involved in it, I do follow and I like a lot of stuff they do. So I did get a little bit of it, but I'm certainly not knowledgeable enough of it to explain it or take sides.
Well, that's very political of you, and I can appreciate that. Just to kind of say what it's about, it's another situation about where a certain a group of people are shitting on or complaining about a different group of people. And the OSR, as I've said many times, to me, is a very personal definition. And it's a nebulous movement that defies definition in many ways, because I mean, I often ask, hey, do you think this is an OSR game or not? We didn't have to get into that in this episode, because obviously Swords and Wizardry is. It's one of the foundations of the OSR, really. But on these different message boards, people are saying that certain types of products shouldn't even be in the OSR, which isn't anything new, but singling people out and basically saying how bad they are or those products are just seems kind of wrong and depressing to me, when really all we're doing is talking about a game that people play for fun, really. Or don't you think?
Oh yeah, for sure. It's reminds me of, there's an old saying, like, why are the fights so vicious in academia? It's because the stakes are so low. You know, I mean, it's laughable to me. Like, you know, being in the industry, I suppose, as a publisher and putting things out, you know, on the market, if you want to call it that, it's so little like money involved that it's really like everyone's breaking even or losing money. You know, even like Wizards of the Coast, right, who owns Dungeons and Dragons, I think they're down to like 10 people who even work on the game. That's all it can support for like full-time salary of artists and stuff, which don't make a lot of money, by the way, right? So, you know, writers and artists. So yeah, it's pretty silly, the whole thing. And I somebody in there, I think Rob Connolly said it in there. It's like, if you don't like it, don't buy it. Like, who cares? And yeah, the whole cult of personality, I don't know, I guess I fall into that too, just because I like a lot of the people, you know, going to the cons and stuff, I meet a lot of the people firsthand, and there's really cool people. So there's a little bit of that cult of personality, and then you get the clicks and the sides, right, form. Yeah, I don't know. There's plenty of products in the OSR I don't like, that I don't think are good, but it's I usually just keep my mouth shut about it.
Hey folks, Chris Nizak here. I'm the editor for Hobbs and Friends of the OSR. We had a little bit of a technical glitch on the end of this episode and lost about 3 minutes. But I wanted to say thank you to Eric Hoffman for being on Hobbs and Friends of the OSR. And thanks, Hobbs, for putting together this episode for Swords and Wizardry Appreciation Day. You can find Eric Hoffman on Google+ under his name, Eric Hoffman. You can also find his games at stormlordpublishing.com. Hobbs and Friends of the OSR is a Misdirected Mark production, the media arm of Encoded Designs.